My guest is Sophie Pedder. Sophie Pedder is the Paris Bureau Chief of The Economist. Welcome to the podcast, Sophie.
Oh, it's a real pleasure to speak to you again, Paul. It's been a while.
Well, it has been a while, actually. It is a welcome back because it's exactly 4 years ago since we last did a podcast together,
Goodness, is it really?
May 2020. Right, let's get cracking. Nobody knows much more about French politics and especially the president, Emmanuel Macron, than you, Sophie. So I'm really keen to ask you a whole raft of questions about the current situation of French politics. And starting with something which may seem rather odd, the European Parliament elections, they are around the corner. And even in countries like France, historically, European Parliament elections aren't necessarily the biggest ticket item that the media focuses on. But this year, it's different, isn't it? Could you tell me what your take is on the stakes of the European Parliament elections as far as Emmanuel Macron is concerned?
Well, I think it is different. I mean, obviously, nobody's expecting a high turnout. There never is for European elections, unfortunately. But it's not about that. It's about the fact that this is the only big election that's going to take place between now and 2027, when Emmanuel Macron is constitutionally forbidden from standing for a third consecutive term. And therefore, it could be a sort of guide or a wake-up call, depends how you want to look at it, about what could happen next. And that's what's interesting. If you take the polls at the moment, it looks like being an absolute runaway success for the hard right, far right national rally. That's Marine Le Pen's party and her candidate who's heading that list, who is Jordan Bardella. And if that's the case, if it turns out to be that, by a huge margin that Macron's party is squashed right into a sort of distant second place, then it's a real knock to him. And it's a worrying sign, I think, for a lot of people about what could happen in 2027.
Well, we'll come to 2027 toward the end of the chat, Sylvie. But in the meantime, to what extent would he do you think he'll try and get away with or be entitled to say that these are just, quote unquote, the European Parliament election? They don't really have any bearing on the national situation.
Well, up to point, it's true that they don't, and in the past it hasn't. You know, the his Macron's party came second at the European Parliament elections last time as well, and that had no impact at all in terms of changing a prime minister or changing government. The difficulty this time, of course, is that Macron doesn't run a majority government anymore, and there will be a lot of pressure on him from the opposition for whatever reasons to dissolve parliament, to react in some way to the European elections. I think my sense is that Macron will try to ignore that, to rise above it, and make the point that you just have, which is that this has got nothing to do with national politics. And certainly the campaign themes at this election that his candidate has been trying to sort of raise have all been about Europe. You know, it's about the future of Europe, it's about Europe, enlarged Europe without NATO, Europe faced with Trump, Europe faced with war on our continent, all the sort of big issue things. But that's not the way that the far right has been playing it. Far right has been doing exactly what you would expect them to do and make it all about Macron, a referendum on him, and all about national politics, immigration and crime, and all the subjects that they are concerned about. So I think he will try and rise above it, but the pressure will be on.
Do you think at least if the results are more or less as you indicated next month, it'll weaken his personal stature in the European Union context because his party will have done so badly? I mean, we're all used to, we'll come to the exclusive interview you had with the president a few weeks ago. We're all used to Macron every now and again coming out with big vision speeches, and to his credit, at least he bothers to do that, whereas many other European leaders are found wanting. But do you think that people will say outside of France that we shouldn't maybe listen to Macron so much because, as you just said, he can't stand for a third term anyway? And secondly, the election results showed he's on the decline anyway.
Well, it's a good question, and it's one that's certainly being asked in Brussels, as you know. But I think, you know, you have to distinguish two things. And one of them is the political standing at home of the president, who will be somewhat weakened and damaged and face quite a difficult time ahead after these European elections by under pressure from the opposition, and the function of the French president. And that function doesn't change because you have had a bad election result, in the same way that it doesn't change for the German Chancellor to have in the way he interacts when he's had bad state result election results. So I think that, if you look at the balance of power around the table in the European Council among the 27 members, I suppose you have to ask, if Macron isn't the one anyone's listening to, who are they going to be listening to? And do you really mean that sitting around that table, people no longer listen to him because he had a bad result? I find that quite difficult to imagine. So I think it's easy to say that. He's still in power for 3 more years. 3 years is still quite a long time. Obviously, the closer we get to the next election, the more it's going to be difficult for him to sort of plan for the after, for after that date. But I find it difficult to imagine quite how this would work to his complete sort of marginalization just because he's had a bad result, even though he's obviously, it's not going to be pleasant for him to have to sort of digest that.
Well, last month he gave this major speech, a lengthy speech as well at the Sorbonne, a kind of rerun of the now well-known Sorbonne speech of 5 years earlier. Am I right in saying that on this time round, it didn't get quite the same kind of rapturous attention that Sorbonne One got?
Well, it didn't, and I mean that is in some respects a reflection of the fact that the novelty of 2017, when there was this young president freshly elected who sort of grabbed the presidency from nowhere, set up a party only a year before. There was that whole sort of sense of newness, freshness. Who is this guy all about? What's he talking about? 7 years on, any political figure is no longer, and certainly one who marked minds so much in at that time is doesn't have the same sort of aura and the sense of novelty. But I think what was interesting was the fact that it was the darkness and the sort of bleak outlook he was painting for Europe. That's what marked minds. And I think this time round it was, when he talked about, he had that phrase where he was talking, he was quoting really from Paul Valéry. After the First World War, he was saying, Europe can die, a civilization can die. And it was that sense, I think, of the fragility of Europe that came out of that speech, even if it didn't get the attention that it might have done. Now, having said that, Paul, it was an incredibly long speech. I sat in the Sorbonne on a wooden bench for an hour and 45 minutes. And, that was a very long speech for anybody to have to sit through. So he didn't help himself in that respect.
Am I right in saying also he tends not to use a teleprompter or even notes? It kind of fluency, his own sense of being articulate, it just flows.
No, he has a script in front of him on a lectern, but I think the discipline comes before that point. He has so many things he wants to pack in and so many alleys he wants to, travel down, that at the end of it you have something that is just very difficult to for the listener to digest and to retain, because there are too many points. This is it's a very French speech. There's a grandness to it, and there is philosophers are mentioned, and there's a lot of abstract nouns, and you have this sort of wonderfully French construction, but it's not at all that Anglo-Saxon way of making a speech with 3 bullet points that you can come away with 3 words for each. So it's a different sort of cultural form of expression, and that's the way he does things.
Well, still talking about his fluency, you recently had an exclusive interview with The Economist, News 30 Better, with the President Macron. I just wonder how did these things come about? I mean, it's quite a coup, obviously, to get an interview anyway, especially an exclusive one, and especially with an Anglo-Saxon media outlet. Can you give some of the background how it all came about?
Well, if you recall, he gave us this interview in 2019 where he talked about the brain death of NATO, and that was, I think, a moment where the headline dominated the coverage of that interview back 5 years ago. But actually, what he did at that time was to lay out a lot of the way he thought Europe was going, what was missing, what the dangers were ahead, and in a sense, it was already a wake-up call back then, because he was concerned about a lot of the things that he's still concerned about today, but with a greater sense of urgency. So I think, we had that sort of precedent of having allowed him to sort of air some of those ideas and challenged him on some of them, as we should, and that's what we're there to do. But I think that it was the fact that we tried to take seriously people that we interview, and that is, I think, why they agreed to sort of repeat the exercise this time at a time when he is very concerned about Europe and wanted really to be able to talk about in a little bit more detail some of the issues that he had raised in that speech, and in particular some of the things he hadn't really talked about that we had on our minds. So I think, that's how it came about. We have a bit of history there, and the timing was obviously for them simpler to do straight after the Sorbonne speech. In a way, it was sort of the kind of follow-up to that.
As a way to amplify his speech, yes, and so on. What's it like being in close proximity to the chap? The word charisma is often bandied around in these contexts, but does he have this aura? Does he have this charisma that is often attributed to him?
I mean, I think that's what strikes people who've never interviewed him or met him is absolutely true. I had with me my deputy editor who came from London, Edward Carr, and he was there with me in 2019 as well. So he knows how it works. But Macron is an unusual person to interview because I think it comes down to the fact that he really listens to questions. And, I've interviewed a lot of people, a lot of politicians in my time. I'm just like you, Paul. And, you know exactly the tricks that they have up their sleeve. They avoid the question. They duck it. They change subject. They answer a completely different question. And that isn't where the way Macron goes. He listens to the question. And he then tries to kind of give you a thoughtful answer and to engage on that subject. And he likes it when you push back, he likes it when you come back and, but that's not what you said last time, or, you can sort of, he likes being challenged, but he is, it's, I'm not sure if charisma is the right word for it. I think it's just sort of engagement and focus, which is really unusual and is extremely kind of gratifying as a journalist, because you mean you really get some into the sort of substance of the subject, and you feel that you've at the end of it had a really proper, serious conversation with someone who seems to be interested by what you're raising and has ideas to exchange on the subject. So, it's he's a really rewarding interviewee.
Right. Well, going back to this bleakness you talked about, especially in the Sorbonne II speech, to what extent do you go along with this quite entrenched narrative these days that the Franco-German axis, as personified obviously by Macron and Scholz, is not what it was, and there are serious, not just disagreements, but the serious tensions between the two countries, between the two leaders. Is that an exaggeration or is that reality?
No, I think that's reality. I mean, the starting point in the Franco-German relationship is always difference of opinion on almost everything. I mean, it doesn't matter what you're talking about, whether it's nuclear power, whether it's fiscal rules, the two countries just disagree. But that's they know that, and they have built over the years, over the decades, mechanisms for making sure that they can somehow meet halfway on most subjects, not all, and sometimes with difficulty, sometimes with ease. But they have to sort of make that work. So I think, it's not surprising that they have different views. I think that what is more worrying is that they, on a personal level, seem to have a real difficulty sort of dealing with each other. You can't invent, can you, two different, more different personalities. I
Yeah.
mean, the taciturn Olaf Scholz, who is extremely careful and measured and cautious in everything he says and he does. Macron, who's extremely tactile and verbose and, a sort of grandiose in the way he both speaks and the visions that he has, is the two of them, I think, find it just difficult to click and to find the sort of chemistry that they need to work. Now, they don't give up. That doesn't mean they walk away from each other. And each time you've seen things get bad, they make an effort and they pull themselves together and they pull the two countries together again. And we've got a state visit to Germany coming up by President Macron. That's, again, a sign of the sort of the mechanisms that pull them back together again working. But it is worrying and it has to be worked at. And it still remains the case that if France and Germany don't agree, however much Macron has worked more recently on alliances with other countries, and it's interesting to see Poland being brought into this in the sort of what Weimar Triangle format, Poland, Germany, and France, as a way of perhaps almost diffusing the tension that exists between France and Germany. If you've got a third partner in there, the British used to play that role. It used to be quite a handy thing for both countries to have a third player to sort of play each other off again. Against, but I think despite that it is worrying that they can't get on better, but it's never sort of so desperate that it's about to fall apart, because the institutions, I think, don't let that happen.
But then going back to this phrase he was quoting, Paul Valéry, Europe can die. Do you think he had realistic or viable solutions or suggestions on how to stop this happening?
Well, I mean, when you pick apart what he meant by that, and that was the my first question was, what do you mean by this? What do you, how can Europe die? And he's got sort of two or three elements to this. One is the geopolitical problem, and that starts with Russia, but it's not just about Russia. It's about Europe being encircled, Iran and others. So there's the geopolitical concern. There's this concern that Europe's being left behind economically. So that's the whole concern about innovation, about tech, about AI, about China, about Europe having sort of the next couple of years to take really important decisions about investing in innovation, and that if it doesn't, Europe could be really fatally left behind. And the third was a democratic worry. So that's a worry about the rise of populism and the rise of authoritarian rulers, both inside Europe and on Europe's periphery. So these were the three kind of concerns. I think that in terms of what to do, it's a complicated kind of web of solutions to all of these. I mean, Macron has his solutions, take the economy, and that's about massive investment. So that would be doubling the budget at the European Union level. That would be massive common debt finance. That would be a sort of public and private investment in all forms of AI, of quantum computing, of all sorts of elements that could give Europe a chance of not being left behind on those issues. Now, that may be the French view, that may be Macron's view. You travel to Berlin, and none of these ideas are going to go down well at all. So, Macron can have his vision as well as his solutions, but as we all know, in Europe, things take place because of consensus, and forging that consensus when you have Germany and France disagreeing, as you just mentioned, is a real problem. So it's not like Macron has a wish list of solutions here, my 10-point plan for solving the problem of populism. It's not that facile, but he, I think, identifies the interconnectedness of all of these things, and that if Europe gets left behind, if Europe is impoverished because of that, then populism is going to continue to be an appealing solution, because people will feel that they have been let down by their elites and by the technocracies. It's the sort of interconnectedness of it all, which I think also makes it a quite compelling piece of analysis.
I can't resist asking this question, maybe a bit too esoteric. As you know, Keir Starmer, alongside Rachel Reeves and David Lammy, is it back in September last year, went to see Macron. I understand at Macron's invitation, by the way. Do you have any sense how that meeting went, or if you, even if you don't, do you have any sense of, in the event of the quite likely event of Keir Starmer becoming Prime Minister by the end of the year, how Macron would look on having a UK, not in the European Union, of course, but having overtly pro-European instincts when it comes to these big picture stories?
Well, my understanding is that that meeting went really, really well. I think that from what I hear, Macron was impressed by the seriousness of Keir Starmer. Obviously, he's a leader of the opposition at the moment, and so Macron can't express much publicly about that. But I specifically asked him during our interview about whether he thought there was an opportunity to do more with the UK, particularly on defence and security. And what I found really interesting in the answers is that he's clearly thinking about this very hard. And one of the things he wants to do to put on the table at the European Political Community Summit, which takes place in Blenheim Palace in July this year, hosted by the UK, but it's the European Political Community, meaning all Europeans on our continent, including those in and outside the EU, and that's why the UK is involved in this. He wants to put on the table some form of reinforced cooperation on defence and security. Now, Macron, the way Macron thinks is, I think, that he doesn't like to think and start with institutions. He likes to think and start with the problem, then think about how to resolve it, and then think about the institutional structures that go around it. So, from his point of view, I don't think it's about turning the European political community into a defence and security institution. That's not the point. The point is, you cannot really ultimately do something serious on defence without the UK involved. And the UK isn't in the EU. And therefore, we need to be creative. I'm paraphrasing Macron here. We need to be creative, and we need to think about ways in which we can bring in the UK. So all this, to come back to your point about Keir Starmer, I think there is absolutely an opportunity, with all the obvious caveats that France has also been the toughest on respecting rules post-Brexit. But there is a sense, I think, that there is an openness in Paris for a more of a sort of creative thinking about how to bring the UK and France and other European partners together, in inside and outside the EU, to to find a way of deepening that kind of cooperation, and particularly in the context of a potential Trump presidency in the US.
Right. I promised we'd come back to domestic politics and the presidential elections in 3 years' time. So last part of our chat was going to be all about that, Sophie. You mentioned just now Jordan Bardella, a very telegenic leader of the Rassemblement National. As since a few months, we have another telegenic personality, Gabriel Attal, is the French Prime Minister. Is even now on the scene, Raphael Glucksmann, who's head of this Place Publique, a kind of maybe embryonic new socialist party, another telegenic personality. They're all men so far, as far as I can see. But do you see, before we talk about the elections in 3 years' time, do you see a new generation of younger politicians coming through, and the Mélenchons and the Bayrous and the slightly older guys are no longer going to be calling the shots?
I think this election, it does seem to reflect a sort of renewed generation. I mean, you talked about the women. Don't forget, Marine Le Pen is still, on the scene, and very much so. And Macron's candidate for the European elections, Valérie Hayer, she's a woman as well. So, there are female candidates who are taken, relatively seriously in this election. But I think the youth of there's been a kind of an extraordinary moment where, Macron used to be the young leader in France, but Macron himself now appears like the sort of, almost the elder statesman, and
After
because
7 years.
after 7 years in power, and at the age of 45, because he's got these, he's himself promoted Gabriel Attal into the Prime Minister's office. Gabriel Attal is 35 years old, and his candidate is young as well. The Foreign Minister Stéphane Séjourné is young. You do have this younger generation. Now, why that's important, in my view, is that big question that people are asking of France is what happens after Macron? Well,
Right.
you've beginning to see an answer to that, at least in the sense of bringing up kind of new talent and giving them an opportunity to give it a go and show what they're made of. None of these names may be there in a year's time or two or three. We don't know. But the point is, at least you have some of the younger generation, and by that I mean younger than Macron, coming up and him, doing his part in sort of promoting that. So, and it's incredibly important. But it certainly makes France, this election campaign, without, Mélenchon is invisible. Marine Le Pen doesn't say a huge amount. She leaves it to Jordan Bardella. But all these faces really do feel like a much younger kind of political scene for France. And honestly, that's quite refreshing.
Well, a final question then, Sophie. There seems to be a certain inevitability about the not just the prospect, but the distinct likelihood that Marine Le Pen, who you just mentioned, will be the next president of France in 3 years' time. I'm struck by that nobody seems to question that. There's a sense of almost resignation. I think it's the third time she will be standing for election. Correct me if I'm wrong. And it's just almost like it's not so much it's her term, but each time she's lost, she's reshaped her strategy, her profile, obviously. So to what extent do you, my roundabout way of asking you, who's going to win the presidential elections in 3 years' time, as far as you're concerned?
Well, I don't like the idea that it's absolutely inevitable. It's actually going to be the fourth time that she's
Fourth
run for the
time, thank you.
presidency if she runs in 2027. I don't like to say that it's inevitable, partly because, I've learned over the years following French politics that things never go by the script. Dominique Strauss-Kahn was going to be president of France, and then we
Right.
all know what happened to that. Juppé and Sarkozy were going to be thrashing it out and for the French presidency, and ended up being François Fillon, who ended up being the candidate for the UMP at the time. These things happen. Macron, who saw that coming? So I don't think it's useful or even necessarily,
Accurate.
a good accurate exactly
Yeah.
to assume that these will happen. But having said that, it's a stronger possibility than it ever has. She's still got to win 50% of the vote, over 50% of the vote, and she hasn't got there yet. And I think that what the centre ground, and by that I mean everyone from the sort of centre left to the centre right, has got to do is work out how to find a credible successor. I think one of the things that struck me most, Paul, in our interview with Macron was he talked precisely about the resignation you've just mentioned,
Right.
but he got really quite worked up, and he said, read Marc Bloch again, read Marc Bloch. In 1940, There was a sense in which the elites were almost complicit in the fall of France to the Nazis. There was a sense in which they were resigned in front of an outcome that they thought was there was nothing they could do about. And that was the comparison which he made, which for me I found quite chilling. The idea that there are some, and you hear the voices sometimes in France, in Paris, beginning to say, oh, well, maybe it won't be so bad. Well, Macron's point was, it's about ideas, it's about fighting, it's about never giving up, it's about never assuming that anything's inevitable. So I think his challenge and the challenge for the sort of the French centre is to engage and mobilise people and that younger generation around that idea and make sure that it doesn't happen in 2027.
Well, we have to leave it there. Sophie Bedda, thank you very much for your time.
It's a pleasure talking to you again, Paul. Thank you.